I will call this meeting of the Children and Families Committee to order. And we have some lovely minutes here. Can I get a motion on approval of the minutes?
Mr. Chair, I would move the approval of the March 4th minutes.
Vice Chair Nelson moves approval of the March 4th minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those opposed say aye. Aye. Not opposed. The motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. It's a wonderful day. I'm glad, you know, we see who are the real champions who brave the weather to make it to committee today. But today we're going to hear a couple presentations from DHS and Think Small. And the idea today is just to familiarize ourselves with what we're going to adopt next year, most likely, and also think outside the box. Frequently, government work can get very regimented, even when extensive public input is taken. And I think we should do our best to, rather than tweak, think more holistically, given how bad our state is when it comes to the cost of childcare and the number of child care providers. So to kick off our discussion, I invite DHS up to give us a rundown on child care monetization project. Representative Hicks.
Thank you. You mentioned our cost of child care, and I agree, Minnesota's cost of child care are a problem, but do we have any cohesive data comparing us to other states? I've been able to find a couple of things online, but if we have anything like that, I would really like to explore it personally. So this was just my flag to ask. If research had something, I would love to see it.
So what I use for a lot of this data is Child Care Aware National Statistics. Representative McDonald, I think you mentioned a website with a hilarious name of some sort. Representative McDonald.
I did. I will find it, Mr. Chair.
There is another website that I know does that information, but I use the National Child Care Aware, and those seem to be pretty reliable numbers. At least I haven't had anybody say they were wrong yet. We'll see if that happens. Anyways, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your presentation.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Larry Hosh. I'm the manager for the Office of Inspector General's Policy and Legislative Team. Also with me today is Brandon Tice, who is one of the project leads for the Child Care Regulation Modernization Project. I'm excited to share the project with you today and a little bit of a status update of what we've done, where we are now, and where we plan on going moving forward. In this slide is a visual representation of the Child Care Regulation Modernization Project. This project came from the 2021 legislature, directing the department to contract with the National Association of Regulatory Administrators. The acronym for that organization is NARA, so I'll use that moving forward. It'll be much more efficient. The legislature directed the department to contract with NARA and to do a project both for our two main primary child care provider types for family child care and child care centers. This regulation modernization project contains three components. One is establishing a risk-based tiered violation system. Two, a key indicator system that would help inform abbreviated inspections. And the third component, the revised licensing standards, which will be the majority of today's presentation. Real quick, though, just want to talk about the first two components that I mentioned, the weighted risk system. A challenge that is faced by many licensing agencies is how to acknowledge that some regulations required of providers pose more risk while others pose less of a risk. And the weighted risk system assigns a numerical score with weights ranging from 1 to 10, with 1 representing almost no risk to a child in care, to 10 representing almost certain risk. By assigning a weight to each regulation, the department has a quantifiable, objective, stakeholder-supported method to show potential impact to children in care if a regulation might be violated. The weighted risk system for weighting of the the weighted risk system, we implemented a survey asking stakeholders to participate in weighting all the regulations that are subjected to child care centers and family child care. During our engagement process with the weighting with weighting of regulations, we surveyed 1,295 family child care respondents and almost 1,000, just one short, of child care center respondents. Of these respondents, 85% of the family child care respondents were providers, 76% of child care center respondents were providers, so very provider-focused. This is a visual representation of what a weighted risk system might look like. We kind of have three buckets when it comes to, you know, the weighting system. One is for low-risk items. We would recommend documented technical assistance, so it's not a direct licensing action or a mark on your report card or anything of the sort. It's something that a licensor can work with a provider, rectify the situation at hand, and then there would be no required follow-up after that. Moderate risk items would be subjected potentially to a correction order, but not required. The weighted risk system is more of a guide than a mandate for licensors. It just helps provide a context on, you know, how should I respond to a certain violation. And then to the far right, the red shaded items, those are the high risk items. And those were determined by taking the top 10th percentile of all regulation standards, and the top percentile as weighted by providers are high risk. Just to give you an example of what the continuum looks like for family child care, the lowest weight given to a regulation was 1.91, and that was a regulation that required licensed applicants to submit an application in their county of residence. The highest risk item was the prohibition that providers do not drink or consume, do not drink alcohol substance or have drug use in the while caring for a child. That was a 9.52. So that's the continuum, the lowest to the highest. For centers, the average rate was 6.72, and the lowest weight was 2.67, which required centers to post their license in a conspicuous place, where the highest risk item was a 9.39, and that was the prohibition of corporal punishment, emotional abuse, or the use of restraints.
Mr. Hush,
yes.
Well, to the members, rather than waiting to the end as we have done in the past, feel free to ask questions as they come up. I regret, but we ran out of time that one time, not letting it happen again. on the weighted risk system, I think there's an obvious question that a lot of members would have when looking at it's the floor of the child care center is 8.5 for a licensing action. It's 8.0 for family child care. What's the reason for the difference there?
The reason is, Mr. Chair.
That's my bad.
Yes. Mr. Chair, committee members, the reason for that deviation is because we took the top 10th percentile for the standards. Because the weights weren't uniform for family child care centers and family child care, and we said we're going to take the top 10% of the highest rated items and categorize them as high risk. So it's even for both, even though, you know, the standards are different because of the different provider type. I should also mention that one of the intents for the weighted risk system is to increase inter-rater reliability, to try to increase consistency among licensors throughout the state. As the committee knows, child care centers are directly licensed by the state, but family child care is a delegated licensing system. So you're dealing with multiple counties, multiple different interpretations of licensing standards, and the weighted risk system helps kind of give a little bit of guidance of saying, okay, this violation is a low risk. Maybe you should just do documented technical assistance, while a higher risk item, you should be looking at a more licensing action, fine, whatever it might be, more follow-up items. So.
I have one more question, then we have a couple members. Is there any movement to scale, say, a fine to the weighted risk system? It's sorted by what action they take. Is there any investigation on what a violation having a higher cost? Mr. Hodge. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Right now, we use fines in limited circumstances, such as when there's a safe sleep violation, maltreatment. We don't institute fines across the spectrum of all licensing regulations. But it could be something that is up for discussion on, you know, for high-risk items, do we want to institute an expectation of a fine? I think that requires stakeholder engagement, discussions with our provider community, what are the impacts to providers and to children in care. So.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a quick question on this weighted risk system. Feel free to tell me if this is just too in the weeds or we're not there yet. But one of the concerns that I've often heard from providers is that when they have some kind of violation and understanding, you know, that there is a spectrum, that information is sometimes communicated in a way that's that kind of obscures what the actual violation is and doesn't necessarily illustrate the sort of correct severity. Like, you mentioned filing a license in the county of residence or another example, you know, not properly displaying the license in their particular location. Obviously, that's not going to be a safety risk. So I guess my question is, has there been any thought or discussion about how, once this weighted risk system is implemented, how that information is then denoted or displayed on licenses and that sort of thing?
Mr. Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Coulter. We fully anticipate that the weighting of regulations would be something that's up, you know, for public consumption and is available to licensors and providers alike and others who are interested. And we always do struggle with, you know, trying to provide the full context of a particular situation, because every provider, every situation is always different. We've had discussions like access to hazardous materials. That can be anything from access to a knife that's left on the kitchen counter to having water on the bathroom floor as a slip hazard. Those are all categorized as hazardous materials. So that's something that we always struggle with, and we want to try to be as transparent as possible, but also within, you know, the realities of being able to post something on a licensing information lookup page. So.
Representative Nadeau.
Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Hosh. It's good to see you. I'm trying to understand the value. I'm trying to understand the value of this. I'm very familiar with weighted systems when we're talking about awarding things or trying to increase the use of something. I'm not as familiar with them from a punitive standpoint. And I also have questions for, when a facility is being inspected for licensure, I mean, there's a list of things. I think it's 290 counties deal with, and they answer yes or no. There's paper towels in the dispenser. And so I'm trying to figure out the value of this in the actual application to providers. Can you spend some time talking about the value of this in that regard?
Mr. Hobby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Nadeau, absolutely. The value from my perspective is a few things. One is it's objective, it is quantifiable, and two, it really aims to try to have consistency throughout the licensor spectrum, because licensors are individuals and human beings and may interpret rules and regulations differently. So this kind of gives a framework of saying, okay, we can quantify through stakeholder feedback in the waiting process that Regulation A is a low-risk item and should be just subject to documented technical assistance. For example, previous to the weighted risk system, and the weighted risk system's not implemented yet, we're waiting for the provider hub to be fully implemented, but previous to this, we had the fix-it ticket system. And fix-it tickets, we had 15 fix-it ticket items for child care centers. We had 20 fix-it ticket items for family child care. And they were kind of just picked randomly as saying, we think this is low risk, but, you know, that was just through using, you know, intuition. Now, with the documented technical assistance items, the low-risk items, we're able to say there's 44 items for child care centers, and there's 63 items for family child care centers that run on that low-risk spectrum and should just be subject to documented technical assistance. Maybe we have a talk to the provider, the licensor gives some technical assistance on how to resolve that issue, and then there's no follow-up required until, you know, the next annual licensing visit happens and they can confirm that it's been resolved.
Representative Nadeau.
Okay, and thank you for that. So basically all this is doing is it's a department, you're looking at this and saying these are the 63 items that we're going to put on the low scale. I mean, the providers are still going to get a fix-it ticket, basically. And it was 44, now it's 63, it sounds like. I'm joking. But okay, I think I understand it, but I just want to make sure that we always keep in mind that, yeah, there is objectivity, and, you know, and that's part of what we do, and maybe that's what we're, part of what we're working on, and so I appreciate that, and so thank you for the clarification. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Hodge.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quickly, I'll move over to abbreviated inspections. One of the goals of this project was to allow for abbreviated inspections. So instead of a licensor visiting a provider and having to go through all 300 of those regulations that a provider is responsible for, how can we do abbreviated inspections? How can we do more with less and be more efficient in our time? So abbreviated inspections will allow for a shortened annual inspection for certain providers who meet eligibility criteria. So for an example, family child care are subject to right around 300 regulations. Under an abbreviated inspection, they would be subject to under 100 regulations that would be monitored at that visit. So how do we get to that list? How do we define, you know, what are the right things to have in that abbreviated inspection list? And we did four things here. One is key indicators. We worked with NARA to develop a methodology of saying, if you comply with this subset of standards, we can statistically predict that you're going to likely comply with all 300. And I can't speak to the details of that methodology. NARA's the experts on that, but we can, you know, pick like 20 subsets of standards, and if a provider complies with those, we can reasonably make that prediction that they're going to comply with all. Second is the high-risk rules. We know that high-risk rules are the most likely to impact a child in care towards their health and safety, so we include all the high-risk rules in that inspection. The third is supplemental rules. As a licensing agency that is subject to federal requirements and CCDBG, what are the federally required rules that we have to inspect for, regardless if they fall in key indicators or a high-risk category? And then the very last bucket is five random rules. Just to keep everybody on their toes so they don't know that, you know, this is the static list that we're going to be inspected by, we would put five random rules in that abbreviated inspection. So that's what we're looking at doing with the abbreviated inspection. We anticipate that over 50% of providers would qualify for abbreviated inspections. And some of the qualifying criteria that we would use would be the number of years a program has been licensed, have they had previous licensing actions against them, you know, prior high-risk rule violations, or any substantiated maltreatment findings or investigations.
So one concern that I've heard on these, everybody likes a shortened inspection, but an inspection for a provider is still, like, it's still a massive imposition, as it should be. So abbreviating it, one concern I have with this is it's great for the department. Department loves it. Less time, then they can get out and inspect something else. But it doesn't help providers as much as I would hope. One idea I would like the department's feedback on in the future is, well, if we have people who meet these high standards, what if a portion of those people at random, so maybe 50%, they get inspection every other year? Or they get to skip a year or something like that, if they have the meet these high standards, because that would actually be a benefit for a provider because it doesn't take up a day, and also reduce the department's workload. But that's just an idea that I heard from a provider that I think has some merit, given it's like, well, an abbreviated inspection is great, but it doesn't actually help the provider, and that's what I think the committee is focused on. As much as we love the department, we really love the providers. Mr. Hodge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and we really value that feedback, and, you know, this is an iterative process where we're not completely static on the approach that we take, and we can make adjustments. For abbreviated inspections, right now we would anticipate that no provider would be subject to a perpetual abbreviated inspection, even if they do qualify with the criteria, that like every 3 years they would be subject to a full inspection, and then if they continue to qualify, they'd have 2 years of abbreviated inspections and have to do another full inspection at the third year. But we're open to feedback. This is, again, abbreviated inspections aren't implemented yet. We anticipate implementation after the provider hub is fully rolled out to all providers.
Okay. I just want to... Oh, sorry. State your name. Brandon Tice, Mr. Chair. Okay, thank you. Sorry about that. Also, just wanted to the idea of skipping it every other year. There is a federal requirement through the Child Care Development Block Grant that there's an unannounced licensing inspection every year. So that would be one area where, as Larry mentioned, we're open to feedback and ideas for implementation, but that's one constraint that we're working with.
Very valuable information, sir. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hosh,
we served together. What was the terms you served, Larry?
Mr. Hosh.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, I believe that was probably 2010 to 2012.
Mr. Chair.
Representative McDonald.
My first term. We're old. We go back a ways. Anyways, enjoying working with you and good to see you. My question for you today is regarding, from your point of view, as you know, Minnesota has one of the largest expensive child care in the nation, and we're very safe. We've said that. We have a record of great safety in our child care, but with that comes almost an over-regulation. That said, you can't be too safe. But from your point of view, do you see some regulations, the new regulations that was, some would say, inflicted, some would say passed into law in the last couple of years, that perhaps the state law went a little bit too far, and therefore causing no necessarily more safe centers, but more expense? Is there areas in which you think we could scale back some of this to lessen the burdens, still maintain safety, and then also lessen the cost for child care?
Mr. Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald. This is a great segue into the next section that we can address, and that's with our revised licensing standards, where we had a first draft of standards that was released. We're in the second draft phase, and we certainly had standards in that first draft that were, I would say, of great concern, and probably, you know, even though they were based on best practices, weren't practicable for implementation. And I would love to talk a little bit about those if I can.
Mr. Hosh.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Now on to the revised licensing standards. This is the third component that the legislature directed the department to do. The department was directed to put together a set of revised licensing standards that are based on regulatory best practices. And those standards must also protect the health, safety of children in care, and also be child-centered, family-friendly, and fair to providers. So I want to talk a little bit about the process that we used and where we are today and where we're moving forward.
Mr. Hosh.
Yes.
I actually don't like doing this, but as chair, you get to make some decisions. I think these exact slides were in the last time the department talked about modernization and the listening sessions. So if we could, unless there's an objection, move to page 14. I will, and to the department's credit, they did take input from child care providers very seriously, went over the top, and continue to do so. So in no way is it saying that, but I feel like our time as a committee is better spent more on a policy-oriented thing. Mr. Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Any opportunity to be as efficient as we can, we certainly want to embrace. So just a little background. We recently, the last time our licensing director was here, Alyssa Dotson, who, by the way, is in the Senate right now, so that's why she's not here. She presented to the committee. She talked a little bit about revised licensing standards. That was just before we released the second draft of standards. So in February, we released the second draft of standards, which incorporated a lot of the feedback and what we heard from providers and stakeholders over 2024. We received almost 1,000 people participating in in-person listening sessions, over 1,600 unique responses to a survey, and draft two reflects a lot of that input that we received. I do want to iterate as well that the second draft is only a draft still. It is not a proposal. We don't intend it to be a proposal. We intend to duplicate the efforts that we've already undertaken in 2024 and use the stakeholder engagement that we anticipate to happen over the next few months to inform a third draft as well. So a couple of the significant changes that affected both family child care and child care centers from between draft one and draft two is one is we simplified cleaning requirements. So language in the first draft was very prescriptive on, you know, what kind of cleaning requirements, documentation, chemicals and solvents that you must use for cleaning and sanitizing. The second draft really simplifies it by reorganizing for clarity, eliminating the documentation requirements, and then also allowing providers more discretion in what products they can use. One thing that I heard over and over again and that I could apply to my own personal life was previously I believe we required that a freezer be cleaned and sanitized every 3 months. I can't tell you the last time I cleaned my freezer sanitizer. And I want to remind the committee that, you know, the first draft was really based on regulatory best practices. That's what we based that draft on because that was the directive from the legislature. But now we're in that phase of what is also fair to providers, protects the health and safety, and is family-friendly and child-centered. So that we're transitioning from what in an ideal world is a regulatory best practice to what is practicable in a real world environment. So that's what you'll see in a lot of these changes. You'll also see a lot of the changes involving the words removing or reducing or simplifying or clarifying. And that's really what the stakeholder process is if we have a draft standard and we see that it's not clear or that it's overly burdensome, we want to make sure that we're responsive to that. Some other changes for both family child care and child care centers is scents. The original language prohibited the use of scented products, aerosol sprays, essential oils. This was intended if a child was in care that had adverse reactions to certain chemicals and scents that they wouldn't be impacted. But we also heard from providers that, you know, it's not the best smelling environment. There's dirty diapers and there's all those realities of caring for a child, and that the use of those scented products are something that providers rely on. So we removed that prohibition and now more relying on if there's a child that does have adverse reactions that a provider would accommodate those on a case-by-case basis. The second item is pets. In the first draft, we had the words, all areas accessible to children are free from animal excrement, hair, feathers, kept free of offensive odors, including urine and litter boxes. The literal interpretation of that was there couldn't be any animal hair. And that was never the intention of the department. We would never want to take away a family dog that is in a family child care environment. And words matter. So we removed that language to make sure that there wasn't a literal interpretation, you know, where you can't have any animal hair whatsoever. And now the words that we use are like all areas are accessible to children are free of animal waste, including litter boxes and their contents. So more simplified, more clear, and not open to interpretation or gray areas. The next one is pests. The original draft one requirements said, you know, you should document when you have pest control or pest removal. That was intended to be like if you had to hire an exterminator and deal with a more intrusive pest in an environment. It wasn't meant to apply to when you kill a mosquito or a fly or anything of that sort. And that was another concern that we heard is like, you're going to make us document every single time that we kill a fly when it's, you know, in the fall. And that was not our intention. So we've made clarifications in those areas. Environmental health areas. We originally had a requirement to test for lead, in particular in exposed soils that a child might be playing in. We heard from providers throughout the state that although well-intended, how do you implement this? Especially for a provider that might be in greater Minnesota on a multi-acre property where a child plays. How do you test? You test every piece of exposed dirt, that's not practicable. So we removed the lead testing requirement. also the water supply testing requirement, in particular for lead and other chemicals. We still maintain the requirements that providers are subject to today, if it's a well water source or of that matter. But if it's a municipal source and it's already tested through other requirements on a municipal supply, there's not a need to duplicate that testing. This draft, the second draft, does maintain a requirement for radon testing. Radon in Minnesota, we have elevated levels of radon in Minnesota, and we know that it's outside of tobacco use, it is the highest contributor to lung cancer. So we do maintain a requirement for radon testing, but we do simplify some things. So instead of having to have a radon test before a license is issued, you can have that radon test within the first 2 years of that license or upon implementation. We do continue to hear from providers that they're concerned about what are the financial impacts. Radon testing is relatively cheap, but the mitigation, if identified, is a concern. So I would anticipate as we move forward, we'll continue to gather stakeholder feedback. If we were to make a proposal to the legislature, how to mitigate those costs would be part of the discussion in the potential passage of, you know, final licensing standards. Also, documentation simplification. I can get into a lot of details on here, but these are the main areas where we really, you know, simplify documentation requirements for both family child care and child care centers. Focused around behavior guidance, you know, when you have a child that needs to be removed, if you have a child that's disrupting the classroom or the care home. Documentation related to children with special care needs or disabilities, and then also different health policies and safety requirements. Some changes that only impact family child care. One is we heard quite extensively that you know, child care providers want to have more opportunities to care for children, especially under school age, and also to address some racial questions. So this new draft has a new license class, the B3 license class. This takes the place of what we typically call the Class D license. The Class D license allowed for up to 9 children when there's 2 adult caregivers and no more than 7 of them being under school age. This new B3 class would allow for up to 10 children and all 10 of those children being able to be under school age. Then we also made updates to the C3 class. Currently, the standard for the C3 license is that you can have up to 14 children with 2 adult caregivers and 10 under the school age with a limit of 4 infants. The new C3 standard or license would be allowing up to 18 children. We heard from providers that, you know, seasoned providers that have done this, you know, done the work for years, to recognize that experience, recognize that expertise, and allow for, you know, a greater ability to care for children. So for those two changes, there's a couple of requirements that we would require to get those licenses. One is to be able to take a look back at the history of compliance of that provider, and then 4 additional hours of training, and that training, those hours of training being behavior guidance, child development, and active supervision. Some additional change, outdoor fencing. Again, this kind of gets to, you know, the provider that, you know, lives on a larger piece of property. You can't really practically have a continuous fence or a natural barrier over the entire piece of property. That's what the standard was in draft 1. Draft 2 now is altered language that allows for, if you can't have a fenced in space, that you create and implement a supervision safety plan. So you can allow the kids to, you know, run free and enjoy the, you know, the great outdoors. Indoor temperature and humidity. The original draft had a requirement that it be between 68 and 82 degrees and also have humidity controls. We are reverting back to the current practice right now where no requirement for humidity controls and that it be heated to at least 62 degrees with no maximum temperature.
Representative Katisa Witu.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for being here with us today. And this walkthrough is super helpful. I know that there's a side-by-side document online that's we can kind of go more line by line should the committee members want to do that. I have a question about this because it came up last week in the presentation from Representative Torkelson and his constituent about the temperature. And one of the things is the 62 degrees is current regulation. What was the driving force to shifting it to be 6 degrees warmer? Is it, I mean, I know infants aren't able to regulate their body temperature. Is there anything having to do with, you know, if you have an infant in the center at any given time, like, is it dependent on age or what's, I just am curious kind of the background of this change and then revert.
Mr. Hopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Katiza Batun. Much of the first draft was informed by several strategies. One is we used national best practices, which was informed through caring for our children, and then also a comparison with other states that are comparable comparisons. I believe we used Washington, Colorado, and Missouri as our comparables. So that's what informed the original proposal. Moving back was, I think we identified that, you know, current practice seems to work. That at 62 degrees, and this is for family child care. Centers may be a little different. But for family child care, that, you know, it seems to work. After talking to, you know, our family child care unit and staff and getting feedback, it seemed like this was an area in which, listening to the concerns of stakeholders and providers seemed warranted.
Chair, Katiza Batun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. It's just helpful background. I hadn't realized that the current floor for temperature was 62 degrees. That feels very cold to me. Also to my mother, who thinks we keep our house too cold, and our house is about 68 degrees. So particularly, you know, in our cold winters, just obviously ensuring that providers are mitigating that with making sure the kids have sweaters, blankets, I mean, all of those things. Yeah, it gives me a little bit of a shiver. Thank you.
I also, going back to the abbreviated inspections, just occurred to me, Mr. Tice brought up the federal issue. Maybe you don't know this off the top of your head, but if you could deliver it to us later, if you don't, if they require annual inspections, is there a threshold for what they consider an inspection? Like you're with the abbreviated inspections, you're looking at 100 data points or something like that. What if you did like four, you know, four an example? Is there a requirement around that you're aware of? Mr. Tice.
Thanks for the question, Mr. Chair. There isn't, as far as I'm aware, but there are federal requirements in the Child Development Fund, Child Development Block Grant, that specifies, the things that need to be inspected, looked at around health and safety in those annual inspections. So, in terms of the federal requirements, those would need to be met and inspected.
Chair Katiza Batun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is just a follow-up on your question. If I'm thinking that I'm remembering correctly, when they did come in and kind of give us a presentation on the annual checks, the abbreviated ones, they said that there were the randomized categories, and if one was not met, then there was something about it dropping, like expanding. And so if you didn't meet one of the things of the abbreviated, then it kind of got less abbreviated because they want to do their due diligence. And I just want to verify that I am remembering that correctly. And maybe that, I mean, kind of just goes to your question.
Mr. Hosh or Mr. Tice? Mr. Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, correct. Yes, if it would automatically, it could flip to a full inspection, and that's using, and that's why we're waiting for the full implementation of the provider hub, which is connected to our ELISI, which is our checklist system. That if there is a, you know, if you don't pass compliance with those regulations in the abbreviated inspection, it would move to a full.
Representative Perez-Vega.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to acknowledge and bring up just the cases that come up to my offices regarding the radon and just kind of get an update because it says that there's every 2 year testings, but the radon levels are so high in my district, right off the river in the west side. I mean, as a first time mom and looking at the houses to purchase in particularly in the west side community, I was fairly alarmed by the radon and how that's not just in my district, but in these old homes. And where at the federal level, you talk about what's happening when these housing loans go out. What are the security measures of that? And how are we being updated at this case study level that it's okay to purchase this home and put a down payment on it, but in the meanwhile, you're sacrificing the health of our kids, of ourselves. So can you elaborate more on just how that testing is for the radon so that my constituents, I can go back to them and tell them that this is what our state's working on?
Mr. Tice.
Thank you for the question, Representative. I can say a little bit more about the radon testing and mitigation. We're very indebted to working with the Minnesota Department of Health, their indoor air unit supervisor there who's been really helping us in this drafting process. So the requirement in the draft licensing standards is that, this is a draft, but it's every two years upon passage, if this were to pass, license holders would be required to test for radon. And then after that initial test, it's every 5 years after that. So radon, it is a gas that can come in through the foundation of either the home or the commercial setting where a center may be. So we definitely want that every 5 years, but that every 2 years at the front end is to your point, what you're saying, of we want to catch that sooner rather than later. So the 2 years, we were trying to strike that balance of giving time for people to come into compliance with this new testing requirement, but also not having it take so long that we were losing time that we could be using to catch issues with hazardous levels of radon exposure. Does that address your question?
Representative Perez-Vega.
To a certain point, I just think as far as when you look at the radon, we talk a lot about the PFAs and what's been in my bonding committee all week. I guess, what can we do to be able to provide more services to those levels of environmental gas issues that are deteriorating the health of our children and our communities? We want to be able to live in safe spaces. We don't want to just tell folks, well, everyone's got a little radon in their home. You got to go back and live with it.
Mr. Tice?
Thank you for that. And that's why this requirement is in the draft being put forward. Mr. Hosh, as Larry mentioned, that's the leading cause of lung cancer after cigarette smoking. So we're trying to have that be addressed for child care centers and for family child care, putting it forward in this draft, but also understanding that there are costs. So we're raising that up for awareness and, for you all to take action on that when we get to the next draft.
Representative Perez-Vega.
Thank you. I appreciate you bringing that up, and I look forward to seeing how we can be supportive here on those the type of education that comes along, especially when we want to invest more in first-time home buyers and what that measures is for security and educating folks on what's happening environmentally. So I appreciate you bringing that in, and look forward to being able to support any way that I can on that.
Vice Chair Hanson.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Perez-Vega, for that question, because I was interested to see that in here, too. But I did hear, just to follow up on this conversation, can you tell me if there are any resources or help, or maybe House Research might have more information about mitigation? So obviously, like, the testing, sure, is important, but then the mitigation is quite expensive. I know my mitigation system cost $7,000. Surprise cost when I bought my house that I didn't know I would need to pay. And so obviously it affects, first-time homebuyers, but I'm thinking in terms of somebody opening a family child care center, that could be a huge barrier to them actually being able to open. So you may test it, they may have a plan for mitigation, but do you support that, or do we have any resources available for families? Providers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Hanson. Throughout this process, I would say we have not heard from providers that they oppose testing in any way. Testing is relatively inexpensive. The real concern is the mitigation part, and that's a concern of the department as well. So I would hope that as we move forward, and if this were to become a legislative proposal, that resources available to providers to mitigate radon, if identified, would be part of the package. But we all also know that we live in a time of limited resources, so it's up to the legislature if that's a possibility or not.
Place your hands.
Thank you, and thank you for that answer. That's exactly what I was trying to get at, because I just find that to be such a barrier. My other question, you have radon testing here, and I don't know if there's a specific level that's been decided, but in my experience, it's been told that there's no considered safe level. So how do you determine what the level of safety of radon is? And then also, then if they do have a mitigation system, what that mitigation system needs to bring that level down to?
Gosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hansen, we rely on the Department of Health at what that safe level is, and I believe it is at 4 picoliter or pico something. So that's the threshold, and that is the average in Minnesota right now. I mean, of course, people are below that and over that, but that for these purposes, that's the threshold for needing to do the mitigation.
Vice Chair Hansen. Representative Colton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just very quick on this, but I wanted to elevate what Representative Hansen and what other folks have been talking about in terms of the financial barriers that exist to addressing some of these licensing issues, because I heard, I think it was up in Mountain Iron, a provider who didn't know that their refrigerator was broken, and when the licensor came in for inspection, it was like 6 degrees too warm or something like that. And, you know, obviously that matters because we know milk and formula need to be kept at certain temperatures, but that's still really expensive to fix a refrigerator. And I did actually have a bill for this last biennium because I think it's a conversation worth having about when we talk about some of these sort of physical space needs and some of these other things. I think it is worth considering how we can provide support, financial support, to address some of these issues that arise. So just wanted to bring that up. Thank you.
Vice Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. Sorry to loop this back, but I just had one last question about it. Is in this conversation about the testing and mitigation, are there going to be, or have you talked about there being requirements for the sound of the system? And I ask this because these mitigation systems are very, very noisy, and depending on what part of the house they end up in, it can like reverberate depending if it's wood floors or whatever that might be. And like in our home, it is quite disturbing, to be honest. So we unplug it sometimes to get a break from the sound of it. But it is a necessary thing for health standards. So I'm just curious if the sound of these systems has come into play at all as something that you're going to measure or look for or require of providers.
Mr. Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hansen. To this date, we have not had that discussion. It's not reflecting the standards at this point.
All right, onwards and upwards.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The last significant change with family child care I'd like to highlight, and again, we have more changes than just this, but I'm just trying to cover the high-level ones, is the fall zone requirement. In the original draft, we had a requirement that there'd be specific materials and depths in areas in which a child might be climbing, swinging, balancing, or sliding. And those depths were determined by the height of a potential fall at 4 feet. In the second draft, we removed those requirements so you didn't have to have 9 inches of pea gravel or 9 inches of a, you know, like mulch or, you know, rubber clippings that help absorb that fall. It was something that we heard, I mean, extensively throughout all of Minnesota, and especially with family child care providers, about the costs and the unreasonableness of requiring that of every provider. So, one more, the activities and equipment. We did take away some of the specificity in activities and equipment, and more just broadened, you know, what we expected to be available to children into categories. And those categories roughly fall along the lines of blocks and dramatic play equipment, books and literacy materials, gross motor activity equipment and fine motor activity materials. This is always a push and pull that we have as a as an agency is, you know, what level of specificity do we want? Specificity takes away the gray areas and takes away the openness to interpretation. I mean, what is an adequate amount of equipment for all children to play with? That licensor A might have a different definition than licensor B. So we can resolve that with specificity and say you must have three sets of blocks. But that also takes away flexibility. So that's something that we do weigh on back and forth as a agency, and throughout this process is between draft one and draft two, we stepped away from that specificity and now are just relying on broad categories.
All right.
Mr. Tice?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to give Mr. Hosh a break here and go over some of the center changes. So the first one I want to talk about is staff qualifications and education. It's first because this is by far where we heard the most feedback in our draft one sessions. So in draft one, we did introduce more flexibility in the how to qualify as a teacher, assistant teacher, in terms of, in some instances, reducing the number of hours of experience required or reducing the education required to meet that qualification. In draft two, we continued to add some more flexibility for qualifying. We worked with the Minnesota Montessori Network to make sure that their credentials were accurately reflected. And we also worked with the Professional Educator Licensing and Standards Board, PELSBY, to update those credential options as well. And we did add a separate qualification option for those with an accredited diploma or associate's degree in child development or early childhood education in this draft as well. But so overall, that draft one is really where we introduced a lot of the flexibilities, but added a few more in this one. In terms of the next change here is around experienced aides. So experienced aides was language introduced into statute, into 245A, a few years back, but this really changes it to be, so aides, those qualifications are substantively still the same, but we redesignated those as aide one. And then experienced aides is now retitled as aide two. So we're trying to show a progression there from aide two to aide two, aide one to aide two. And what we did with aide two is you are no longer required to track how those staff are used. So those individuals, they need to be 20 years old, and there does need to be a teacher on site on the facility, but there was existing documentation requirements around you can only use one per certain number of teachers and assistant teachers, and you had to document their usage. That has been removed in this draft, so you no longer need to document those, so you can use them more like your other staff. We also reduced the hours of experience required from 4,160 to 2,080, so that's a change here. We also have a new expanded definition of education. So in draft one, we had an expanded definition of education, but it had two parts, general education and post-secondary education, child development education. So that is the post-secondary coursework that you can take to qualify as a teacher or assistant teacher. That licensing counts towards that. What we had with that requirement was that 50% of your education had to come from child development. And we did that to try and balance having some specificity in terms of child development specific content. We heard feedback that with the way it was written in the draft, that would actually end up restricting opportunity. And our intent was to try and expand opportunity. So we just have one expanded definition of education. So it includes things like science, math, social studies. So individuals with those kind of college education, they can now qualify, count that as qualifying as a teacher for a child care center. So essentially, it's an expansion of the types of education that can count when you need to qualify as a teacher or assistant teacher. Promise that one was the most complicated. Okay. Our next slide here is around the training requirements. So we did have the child care basics training requirement in draft one. This is a concept for a new training to be developed by DHS, and it would require be mandated for all center directors, all staff, and unsupervised volunteers. Essentially, it's establishing a foundational and free training for those working in child care centers is what the intent is. And then in draft two, the only change we made there really is just making it, taking out some of the content areas that were called out in draft one, because we want to be clear, it's still an emerging concept and up for discussion in this next round. Orientation and child care basics training also may count towards in-service training hours now, which is a big area of feedback we heard of wanting to count those hours to make training a little more manageable in people's busy schedules. Next slide.
Vice Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just curious about the training. Is there, do you have like any kind of criteria or any feedback about what that training at minimum must include or what folks are looking for it to include? I'm just curious because we are talking about adding some more things like how to recognize youth sex trafficking, how to recognize abuse, how to report child abuse or suspected child abuse, things like that. So just curious if that would be included in these trainings.
Mr. Tice.
Thank you, Representative. I know that under Minnesota Statute 260E, there's mandated maltreatment reporting, and that certainly applies to those working in child care centers and I want to say all licensed settings. one topic I mentioned that child care basics training would be that foundational training, and that's very much still conceptual. But I know in conversations we've talked about, mandated maltreatment reporting duties would certainly make sense as being covered under that training.
Vice Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for that information. I will maybe put ourselves out there and say this committee would love to provide any input that we could on that, just knowing kind of what some of the cycling things that we're seeing and trending issues throughout the legislature. Most of them come back to this committee, but I think a lot of folks here would have really great ideas about what to be sure that at minimum includes. Of course, we hear from a lot of our constituents who have had some variety of issues and, you know, sometimes wishing that were included. Sure, we could pass a law for that, but I think that takes longer. And if we have an opportunity to just include one piece of training into this, that would be really helpful. Thank you.
Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have one question on the slide back with the aid one and aid two. Is there a component in there that would allow an aid two to have more independent time with students without a teacher in the room? Can you talk about that a little bit? And then I have one other question on the training requirement.
Mr. Tice.
Thank you for the question, Representative. As far as I'm aware, in draft two, we retain much of the, in terms of their percentage of time they can be independent with children, it's the same as with the current experience aid requirements. I don't want to say off the top of my head exactly what the parameters are around that. So that's something that we could find and get back to you on.
Thanks.
Representative Nadeau.
And on the training requirement for sort of the child care basics training, indicating that DHS is going to develop this training, are there accreditations? Are there industry associations? I work for a governing institution, and we develop training for the people that work in our departments. We don't develop training for construction people. We don't develop training for people who are serving people with disabilities, for example. That's more of an industry standard. Is there? Will this training, as you see it, will it involve outside entities rather than a group of legislators or DHS people standing around and trying to figure out a training program for child care providers?
Mr. Tice.
Thanks for the question, Representative. Yeah, we certainly are, as I said, it's a concept. It's actually one that we've gotten a number of positive feedback on from providers, though. Because of, just really going over those foundational pieces, we've heard that, especially, with the staffing crisis and, centers having to get creative with staffing, that sometimes they're coming in and they're not fully sure, the staff aren't fully sure what they signed up for. There's always the one story we hear of the staff person who was like, well, it seemed like it was going to work out great until I realized I had to change diapers, like, in this job. So the really by providing that foundation and having DHS provide it, it gives centers less guesswork in terms of, oh, now, I need to make sure to train my staff on all of these different pieces that is part of licensing, such as mandated maltreatment reporting and what is licensing, things like that. So that's some of where it comes from. and certainly would want to do it, you know, with input from the provider community. But that's some of what the concept is.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, outdoor activity requirements, some changes here. Draft one introduced a requirement that outdoor activities must be offered for children who are attending 3 or more daylight hours per day. There was some confusion about that piece. So draft two, a change we made is we increased this to add more flexibility, and we just changed it to for children attending 6 or more hours per day, you need to have some kind of outdoor activities. We also added in some language that clarified, infants would be included under this at least once per day, having an outdoor activity for infants. But we added more language in draft two, clarifying what as practicable means there. Basically, you know, it's based on weather conditions, it's based on the individual child needs. Just trying to make it clear that obviously for very young infants, there is flexibility there with as practicable, but trying to have some licensing standards in place for getting children outdoors.
We have a question here from Representative Sensenmura.
Yeah.
Thank you, and I don't know, thank you, Chair, thank you to the desk. I don't know if you're gonna go more into it, so apologies if I'm kind of going in early, but I just had a couple questions about this slide. So one is, what are the current regulations for any outdoor time for children? And I think the reason I have questions about this is because I definitely agree that outdoor time is really good for children. I think especially, you know, I heard coming from some childcare centers that had to get or made the decision to get kids outside more, especially during kind of the worst of the pandemic, where they were almost doing like, you know, a lot of like outdoor school almost because they felt like it was safer, that they've seen a lot of really positive results and have then thought about like, okay, how do we incorporate more of that into our kind of everyday schedule, even if it feels a little bit safer and not as much about the germs, but more just about we know it's good for kids. But I've also heard from other childcare centers where they're saying, you know, when you're looking for space to put a childcare center in, that outdoor can be a really tricky part of it. Like ideally you would have a fenced in play area, but especially if you're in a more urban area that might be hard to find. You might have a park that's a few blocks away, but getting kids there every day might be hard. And so I've definitely heard that to be a barrier to people maybe opening childcare centers. So can you kind of speak to just like the requirements around outdoor play? What are they right now and what would they be if these new regulations are passed? Thank you.
Thank you for the question, Representative. So the current requirement is that there's indoor and outdoor activities offered daily. So there is a requirement to go outdoors once essentially daily. But that's as specific as it gets right now.
Representative Sensenmura.
Thank you, Chair. So I guess my question is then, you know, is that really limiting kind of where a child care center can be? Or like, you know, I'm just thinking about that, especially the language as practicable, like what if, you know, does that mean that, you know, maybe in the winter you're not going outdoors because walking in the park is harder versus in the summer you are? Or can you maybe talk to some of those nuances?
Mr. Tice.
Thank you, Chair, Representative. That's certainly a piece of feedback that we're hoping to get in this next draft is, you know, if there are those concerns. As mentioned, there's the current requirement to go out outdoors daily, but, you know, this is more specificity. This is more and more for those older age groups, for, you know, toddlers, preschoolers, school age, it would be twice per day. So I could see, you know, this is where we're hoping to hear from providers if that is going to cause issues and concerns, again, trying to balance that. That outdoor time that we know we all benefit from and we wish we got more of, and the reality of it's for the whole state. So that's it's a good point. So, you know, thank you.
Representative Sensenmura. All right. Well, if we can finish this in the next 11 minutes. I know it's mostly us making it take us the time. So just target end within 11
absolutely
minutes
I
so that we can have ample
we're
time.
We're almost there. Okay, the last thing, just want to call out on the outdoor activities, was that we did, and again, just want to clarify, for infants, it's once per day. For those older age groups, it would be twice per day. For those in attendance, more than 6 hours. And then the last thing is for outdoor temperature guidelines, we aligned that language with the Minnesota Department of Health outdoor temperature guidelines, which says above 90 degrees accounting for heat index and below negative 15 accounting for wind chill. Those are the bounds of what's considered suitable weather. So if it's outside of that band of temperature, you know, the expectation is, okay, that's unsuitable weather. You don't need to go outside. But just want to make sure that's clear to the committee as well. I think on the, oh, and then equipment, sorry. I did the same thing. Okay, on accessibility of equipment, we clarified the distinction between what must be available on site versus what you need to have. Sorry, let me go back. Essentially, we're clarifying there's those equipment lists, and we do retain that in the center draft. As Mr. Hosh was mentioning, you know, those equipment lists of specifying what equipment must be available for infants, toddlers, preschoolers, et cetera. So we do still have those. We made some changes to those. But we also added a language clarifying that you need to have that available on site. But you, in terms of what you need to have each day, that's just the sufficient equipment for children attending care on a given day. So trying to build a more flexibility with that language. And we also clarified that you can store away musical instruments and art supplies. They need to still need to be available daily, but at certain times of day, you can put those away so that, you know, your toddlers aren't throwing paint everywhere or whatever the case may be.
Mr. Hosh.
Yes, Mr. Chair, on Larry Hosh for the record. I know time is short, so I will just say that we are moving forward in our public engagement and stakeholder engagement work with draft two. We anticipate over the next few months into early summer that we'll be having multiple opportunities, both virtually and in person, getting additional feedback. We really encourage the committee and others to reach out to us with that feedback. It's very important. We've seen substantial changes between draft one and draft two. We want to continue to iterate, and we want to have a product that works for both families that expect the safest and high-quality environments for their children in care, but also supporting providers in the very important work that they do.
Thank you, Mr. Hosh and Mr. Tice, for your very thorough presentation that touched on many of the biggest concerns, especially the last one on accessibility of toys and whatnot. I've heard that repeatedly as a repetitive grievance, so it's good to see that's being done. Thank you for coming before the committee, and I'm sure we'll have more questions for you later.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, moving on, I invite Clara Sanford up to talk about this modernization movement and child care regulations in the context of child care centers.
Ooh, I got the chair.
It moves. So one thing, if there's anything that was just in that presentation or based on member questions you think you can provide, that would be extra preferred. But please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. I already edited based on what has already been said. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, nice to see you again today. I'm still Claire Sanford, and I'm still Government Relations Chair on the board of the Minnesota Child Care Association. And I'm super excited to talk about the Regularization Modernization Project. We've been super supportive of this ever since it was created. We actually worked with former Representative Wazlowick sitting over there on the bill that got this going for centers in addition to family child care. And we knew the process would not be quick and would require several years of work, but I'd be lying if I said we thought it would take this long and still not yet have any of it implemented. And I'd like to talk about two pieces of the project that were just presented by DHS, the risk-based system, the weighted risk-based system, and the revised licensing standards that we were just discussing. The weighted risk-based system is probably the thing providers are most excited about because it will offer more transparency and fairness for both families and providers. And this was the first part of the project that was undertaken, and we understand that it's pretty much ready to go, and we hoped it would already be in use, but it can't be implemented until certain IT functionality is available through DHS. So it has been delayed and is now slated, hopefully, to be implemented sometime this summer. I really wish we could have moved forward with that part, even without having worked through the other pieces yet. I think the more we delay that part of the project that clearly shows what violations a provider incurs and how severe they are, the more issues we create. The problem, as was discussed, is that the current system gives a level of information and language used that sometimes makes it look like there's a fire when really the fire alarm is just chirping and needs battery and is super annoying. Example, as was already discussed, hazardous materials available to children. Sounds pretty scary, totally reasonable to give families pause. The problem is right now you only get that headline and no context about the severity. Issues like that, of course, create provider frustration, reputation issues for your program in the community, potential loss of families, et cetera. But there's another problem that we haven't discussed that I'd like to draw your attention to that directly affects provider costs. You'll see a letter in your committee materials from Amy Jo Van Cullen. She is an insurance professional who has spent many years working with MCCA and with childcare businesses, both centers and family childcare. And in that letter, she raises the alarm about what such broad licensing citations without context do to a provider's ability to get and keep liability insurance, and thus the ability to operate at all. Licensing records are a key part of insurers' risk assessments. And just like families, insurers don't want to go near a provider that leaves hazardous materials available to children with a 10-foot pole. Provider premiums are rising astronomically, and more providers and potential providers are being flat-out dropped or denied coverage, both in Minnesota and nationally. And if providers are lucky enough to retain coverage, they really have no choice but to pass those cost increases on to parents or make the decision that they can't operate. I don't know what resources or authority DHS might need to at least get this risk-based piece over the finish line and get the technology done, but we want them to have it. We can't keep waiting to implement the first pieces of this project that are already pretty much ready to go, even if the licensing standards are still in process. The delays are having tangible negative effects on provider operations and insurance coverage.
Ms. Sanford, on the way-to-risk system, you believe that that could help with the insurance premium situation?
Yes. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair and members. Yes, and that is what Ms. Van Cullen is saying as well. If there is more context available to insurers, they can more adequately figure out what risk they may or may not be taking on.
What have we seen? Do you have any data from other states that do a weighted system or something like that that we could directly point to any of this?
Mr. Chair, I do not. To the best of my knowledge, not many states have a weighted system. I believe there are ones that Minnesota is looking at as it creates its own, but it's not a widely used system nationally at this point. We're kind of on the leading edge if we can, get it done.
All right, go ahead. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The second thing I'd like to talk about that we were just discussing is the updated licensing standards, the third part of the project. When the first draft of these was released last spring, there was a lot to like and also a lot that seemed unnecessarily complicated. But it was a draft, and we knew revisions would be made. MCCA did not call for a delay in the process, but did want to see some additional drafts to ensure that feedback was being incorporated before a legislative proposal was presented. And we submitted extensive comments to the department. In the end, there was enough frustration from the overall provider community that we ended up with at least another year of delay on the implementation of these standards that we've been discussing. And I really think had the risk-based system and abbreviated inspections been implemented before that was released, we might have avoided that, because a lot of provider feedback on that first draft was that the standards didn't feel very supportive, it seemed like licensing was trying to punish instead of partner, and the risk-based and abbreviated inspections are designed to address those concerns directly, but in the absence of implementing them, providers hadn't experienced any of that and frustration boiled over. Because of that, we're unfortunately not currently considering a bill to update licensing standards this session as originally planned, but there could be a silver lining. One major recurring theme of our feedback on that initial draft was pointing out areas where licensed childcare and public preschool programs are not held to the same health and safety standards. A four-year-old is a four-year-old no matter what building they're in, so why should they be regulated differently? While the new second draft is simplified, shorter, and provides much more clarity, the issue of parity among regulations for different settings involving the same age children is still an unanswered question. And I believe without an express desire or direction from the legislature for such a review to take place, it won't happen. But with the additional time we have, since we're delaying the licensing standards, this could be the moment to do it. To its credit, the DHS modernization team did reach out to MCCA about this feedback and asked how to do a parity review and seemed genuinely interested in looking into it. And I also want to say the team at DHS Regulation Modernization has been excellent to work with the entire time. Of course, the regulators and the regulated were always going to have some differences of opinion, but they have been so, so good and thorough about really wanting feedback and taking it thoughtfully into consideration, which I really, really appreciate. So they reached out and said, how would we do parity with public schools? So we spoke to DCYF, which now houses both licensed childcare and the formerly in the Department of Education public pre-K programs under one roof, and said, where could we direct DHS to look? And we could not be directed to any detailed statutes or rules for comparison. We were told that such a comparison was improbable because the accountability systems for childcare and public schools are so different, which they are. School boards or schools answer to an elected school board, for example, which is something that DCYF brought up. But I guarantee there is no school board in Minnesota sitting around debating whether or not staples should be allowed on a preschool classroom bulletin board. This is likely the difficulty in parity because apart from some high-level standards for public pre-K, there are no specific regulations managed to anywhere near the level of licensed providers serving the same age children. I'd like to direct your attention to something I believe is in your packets. It says Department of Education at the top, voluntary pre-kindergarten and school readiness plus statutory program requirements. From the DCYF, So these requirements, it's a little over 3 pages long. There's nothing in there about classroom equipment or supply standards, requiring that teachers have sight and sound supervision of children at all times, hazardous materials, or any of those things. From the DCYF website, linking to this document, it says, the full list of statutory program requirements are available on the linked document. Each school district, quote, signs a statement of assurances at the time of application that indicates that the district, as well as mixed delivery sites, of which there are pretty much none in Minnesota, that's another issue, will administer and provide voluntary pre-K or school readiness program according to all of the requirements and comply with all applicable federal, state, and local laws, ordinances, rules, and regulations, end quote. So that's for the public preschool programs. They don't have the equivalent of licensors from the state agency dropping in to inspect that they're following those rules. They sign a document saying they'll comply with those rules, and that's it. And as Mr. Hosh, there he is, I keep pointing that direction for some reason, as Mr. Hosh spoke about earlier, there's a constant push-pull with something like what equipment should be in a classroom. And while the second draft of revised licensing standards is much better than the first, it still, for example, goes into excruciating detail about what should be in a classroom for four-year-olds. It will tell you the number of rugs, the number of books, the number of musical instruments, sets of blocks, number of chairs, how many square feet of bulletin board space you need to have, and that your mirror must be 12 by 36 inches, and you will get cited if it's 12 by 35. I've seen it happen. So that's what is in the updated draft for centers, whereas the bullet point on the requirements for the school pre-K simply says, provide instructional content and activities that are of sufficient length and intensity to address learning needs. The end. Like, you're the educators, you're the experts, figure out how to do it. So, licensed childcare standards, of course, need to be more extensive, most particularly because infants and toddlers are a higher risk group, not so much served by public schools, and need more protections. but we very much feel that for 3 to 5 year olds, which are the ages most served in public schools, that standards should be similar, if not equal. The delay of this part of the project, though we didn't want it, could be a good thing if it allowed for this type of parity review. So basically, I just want to say a lot of very good work has been done on this project, but the pressure is on to get it over the finish line for several of the reasons I've brought up and get at least some of the pieces working to support providers and families. In closing, and I know you're all thankful to hear those words, I'd like to mention that last summer, several advocates and state staff attended a national conference that happened to be held in Minnesota where a new and potentially transformational way of looking at regulation and quality monitoring was introduced. And it's been causing chatter ever since. And as we move forward with regulation modernization for near-term improvements, MCCA certainly is interested in being part of the conversation exploring this new idea, which has the potential for long-term simplification of our regulatory structure. And my colleague, Ms. Moss from Think Small, has been exploring this concept in detail far more than I have, and I'm excited to hear what she has to share with all of us when I'm done, if you have no questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sanford. Representative Hicks.
I don't believe this question is for Ms. Sanford, and I don't see anyone from the department here today. Maybe it's because of the snow. But I would like to know what the timeline for the IT updates to be able to move to this system, weighted risk system looks like. And I don't see who I think probably knows that answer in the room, but if we could get that answer. And then also, what is the timeline? And if there are any particular barriers to achieving that timeline, I'd like to know that as well.
I'm sure the department heard that somewhere. We'll put it in an email and make sure they get that question because it's a very valid question. Anybody else? Representative Nadeau.
Chair, and thank you, Ms. Sanford, for coming and pointing out some of the differences between the way that we treat children in school-based preschool settings and in center-based settings. I think it's interesting. I want to take you back to costs. The letter that was in the packet was talking about insurance costs, and we've had a debate recently here about how costs that child care centers incur don't affect what parents pay. Can you talk to that? If insurance premiums are increasing, is that just something that centers will eat, and or will those costs be passed on to parents?
Ms. Sanford.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Rep. Nadeau. The only sources of revenue that a child care provider has are either public funding through children they may or may not have enrolled who are using early learning scholarships or child care assistance, or private pay tuition from families they serve. So any costs incurred by providers have to be paid for by those two. And individual businesses only have control over what they charge private pay families. So any costs that are going to be passed on end up there. And providers, I think this is what you're getting at, and tell me if I'm screwing this up. Providers try extremely hard not to pass costs on to parents, and we have providers all over the state who are charging families tuition that is too low to sustain their businesses because they know that families in their community can't afford to pay anything more. And that's really sad. It shouldn't have to be that way. So providers will eat those costs up to a point, but it gets to a point where it's not viable anymore, and that's the concerning part. Providers can't just eat the costs forever, and I would argue that they shouldn't be eating the costs they are currently in some cases, because it's undermining their own ability to provide quality for their children, their families, and their staff. But they feel so strongly about trying to meet families where they are, that they're willing to do that sometimes and not make the best business decisions out of the goodness of their heart.
Okay, we're very short of time here. Good. Okay.
And now
talk to Representative Turbo Lightning about how to do this.
And thank you. You know, so when the legislature has the ability to reduce costs on providers, we should try to do it without thinking that there's going to be a guarantee in lower costs to families, for example. And I'm only going to state this because we had this debate, you know, just this week about lowering property taxes for family providers. It may not guarantee a lower cost to providers, but it will, or to parents, but it will ensure that we're lowering the cost to the providers providing that care. They'll be able to provide care longer at lower rates. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Doe. I want to move on to Cindy Cunningham to provide the family child care perspective, and then to Ms. Ma. So please get up. Very patient you have been. Everybody has been patient.
What's it going to do?
I know it's a sacrifice for you to make time to come here, so thank you for doing that. Please begin your testimony, and we'll come
the
up with questions
helps.
On the way. Obviously, time is of the essence.
I'll see if
so
I can.
So sorry for rushing.
Give me
here.
5 minutes. I'm going to see what I can fill. thank you. She's warned me of the chair. I'm trying to figure out what I'm trying. Okay, hi. thank you for having me here today, Representative West, Chair West, and committee members. Snow made it a little bit easier to be here today. I was going to close early, and I just told everybody to stay home because I didn't need to be on the road. I've been a licensed family child care provider in St. Paul for 27 years. Sometimes I think I don't sound like I care for children, as I've been involved with public policy for over 15 years, including currently serving as the public policy chair for the Family Child Care State Association Leading Care. In these roles, I have participated in many task forces, including the Family Child Care Task Force, where the Modernization Project originated from. Many working groups, sometimes too many meetings to count, but thankfully to virtual and NAPS. I can join. I have also written as a trainer and a course writer. I have written trainings for providers, family child care providers, to understand how to read and follow Rule 2, and also on inspections. I don't do any interpretations, but direct them in the right manner. So I'm fairly versed on what current rules are and in this process. Topic of family child care is very complicated. It is unique as we are small businesses. I have loved having my own business and caring for children and families for the last 27 years. I'm trying to skip through here, sorry. The heavy-handedness of regulations, the poor communication with programs, and the inconsistent implementation in the counties is what is driving many programs out of business. To be clear, my words are to be about systems, not individuals. Everyone is doing the best they can. We can all do better. There's too much focus on I am much more focused on the system than I am on the detail, though I can talk through the detail. I think you've just experienced with DHS what next session will look like. We're going to be presenting this whole package and trying to go through and rewrite, and that has great concern for us. Regarding the weighted risk, I agree with Ms. Sanford. That is one of the pieces we've really looked forward to. The Fix-It tickets came out of Rochester area. Olmsted County Family Child Care Providers is where it began and has been well utilized, though it hasn't been updated and has been on hold. It's supposed to be updated annually. It's been on hold because of this other process going through. Prior to the modernization project, there were attempts to update and merge the laws that we are under, but they did not go through. We discussed in the task force at length and had presentations by NARA. There were those on the task force who had concerns regarding the impact of having a national organization in the mix. Fears of overreach and unrealistic expectations from a high-level system, which would then possibly be unattainable. Possible increasing regulations we were already struggling with. At the time, there were DHS staff who assured us of engagement and process, which would help alleviate those concerns. Once the law passed, we moved forward with hope that those fears wouldn't be realized. Then we had silence for a few years. There were years lost in this process of getting done from 21 until last year's draft. So we consider that many of the fears have been realized. The first draft, as has now been stated clearly, was obviously just the high-level regulations. In my judgment, sitting here listening to all this, I think we lost a year. why was this not engaged? Why was this not reviewed? Why didn't those NARA regulations get the scrutiny in Minnesota before we had the upheaval? Lead in Care did lead. After a week into the looking at the first draft, we did do the delay. I was horrified to think that we were somehow going to be sitting here this year trying to figure out how to take this process and that draft and turn it into something that we could actually all live with. There were, for engagement, there were surveys ahead of the first draft being written in fall 2024. The number one for family child care providers was deal with ratios. It wasn't anywhere in the first draft. In fact, it was stated to me by DHS that they couldn't do that, couldn't find a way to do it without compromising the health and safety of children. We began to believe that that was from NARA or it was at DHS's own views. We worked, I'm going to use as an example, when this came out, it did not feel like a draft. I was chastised by DHS staff. It's a draft. It didn't feel like a draft. Our community was horrified and reacted in many ways. The reason I say it's not simple as a draft is I can give an example that we finally got through last year, is that we, from 23 to 24, tried to work with DHS to get something as simple as a CPR expiration date updated. DHS put it through the way they wanted it, without consultation and engagement with providers, and it did not fit where we wanted. We worked with DHS. And then in last session, I went to legislators and said, we just want a modification on when that expiration date is. The legislators reviewed it with DHS and came back to us and said, sorry, that's the way DHS wants it. And I said, so you're not going to help us? And they said, no. I finally was able to get a DHS staffer to help me work with a legislator, and we were able to get the modification through. I will say at this point in time, the help page that this where our, we're supposed to go, DHS has neglected to update that this one point on that page, so that modification, that 90-day extension that I negotiated with them, is nowhere on our help page. So they still present the legislation as they have. And this, on the modernization project, we wonder why it's going to be any different. DHS is going to bring this bill forward without more input. So this draft, this input is going to come forward. And we have been told beginning of February, before session starts, we have no idea how we will be able to read the public draft that you are going to get to have to deal with and be able to kind of come up with any alternative views of what's going on. We did work with Senator Wicklund and Representative Coulter and Representative Cotizu-Hatun, to get a bill that has been dropped that needs to be heard to update the modernization bill as it is in law. The things that we are basically doing is putting it into law that's 2026 that will be presented. It currently says 2025. We also have pushed for what is currently in rule, which is that there be a third-party consultant. DHS keeps saying that the legislators said NARA is supposed to do this. That's not the way the law reads. NARA was to be used as a consultant, and if used as the consultant, they were supposed to be doing all of the engagement. We feel that that has been a fail and has not been used. So DHS has taken over the engagement, and we are struggling to understand how that's going to happen. One of the things that is being, was struggling, that we've got in the new bill with a correction, is that there would be a requirement for language translation. Really nothing about Spanish, ended up creating a training, a two-hour program for a Latino group it was an amazing experience. We had two people translating. I was presenting to them so that they could figure out what this modernization project was, because DHS refused to translate and refused to provide the supports. I say refuse because I asked repeatedly, as they did. I don't think that's my job. So we want the translation so it is accessible. Commissioner Brown earlier today in another committee mentioned about the deep engagement. We would argue that that's not accurate. We're only getting to do it after the fact. There's not the pre-engagement. The ratios weren't done in the first to say the 400 people in attendance at a webinar where questions cannot be answered is hardly engagement. When they ask, there's no plan for individual engagement. Associations groups have been asked to submit that we want to engage. Lead and Care did do that, and we received our options to have engagement. All three of the time periods are during daycare hours, and I'm not so sure that this is going to work. We don't consider it really engagement. The MIFs did the heavy lift for getting the engagement for the first round, DHS. We do not believe they did step in and do it, but it wasn't priority. They have indicated they possibly will use the MIFs to get individual engagement. Leading Care is just dedicated to do it. We are continuing to engage and work in response. The full project is going to be brought forward to you in 2026, and I'm just going to sit here. You've seen the preview. Good luck. I don't know how it's going to work. None of what is being presented right now is for sure going to be in the next. It's going to all be a surprise package. We need the oversight to be experienced with our licensors, and communication is what we're missing. Right now, DHS has determined that they are not going to give family child care providers direct information about implementation or changes they're making in interpretations. Once a month, they present to licensors, but the licensors are not required to show up to for the trainings, and so we're getting an incredible amount of inconsistency. The project was supposed to bring together 9502 and 2458. Changes, make some tweaks, do what needed to be done, and we are no farther ahead. We want to keep children safe. We also want to care for children. We are also in discussions with the potential new way of looking at license, simplifying many of the things. Right now, there's very little in 9502 that we couldn't live with except ratios. So it could be a really simple merge of the two systems, and I know you heard a center person come in who basically attempted to do that, done in a more sophisticated way or a higher level way. That would at least get us through the ballgame next year. A couple changes as needed, and then move forward, and we can continue to change it because it will be in legislation, not in rule. So I'll end. Thank you,
Ms. Cunningham. That was another lightning pin, because I appreciate you being brief. I don't think we have time for questions for you. I apologize. But please get us if any members has any questions, please get it to us. We'll get it to them and get answers out to the whole committee. And last item on the agenda, Ms. Maz, thank you for your patience.
Of course,
and
Mr. Chair and members.
We'll probably end up in the same members. Please hold your question.
This is a trick
I tried
here
to talk over it for you.
Man.
Please hold your questions.
I'm outing myself.
Do not hesitate to load us up so that we can have a full, robust, written questions to send your way about this.
I would love that.
Go nuts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm going to read the bold things in my notes, and I didn't have access to a printer, so I'm going to look at my screen, but that doesn't mean I'm not paying attention to you all. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Erica Moss. I work for Think Small. Think Small's mission is to advance quality care and education of children in their crucial early years with a goal of ensuring that all children are ready for kindergarten. So we come at licensing conversations from a little bit of a different perspective. For many years, we've looked at licensing to assure a basic level of safety and have left it to others to figure out exactly what that includes and how it is operationalized. To shortcut it, I haven't been part of a lot of the conversations like just happened here in committee today, and for that, I often feel great relief. We have meanwhile been focused on the parent aware ratings. Licensing is the subject of the hearing, so I won't talk in depth about parent aware, but I want to make the connection for you all. Parent aware was built to be a quality assurance mechanism that rests on licensing, with licensing providing a foundation for health and safety, and Parent Aware offering a framework for supporting children's development through play in all developmental domains. Before I get to this big idea that Ms. Cunningham and Ms. Sanford alluded to, I just want to tick through a few observations that we have about the licensing system, and I think that Representative Nadeau got at some of this with his question earlier. So Minnesota relies on childcare licensing for a lot, probably too much. Whereas in other professions, licensure is primarily about facilities. In childcare, the facility license goes well beyond safeguarding
children's health and safety, to regulate aspects of quality, and to regulate not just the qualifications of the professionals working in programs, but their behaviors as well. This is unique. I have some information that I'll share separately with the committee about the number of pages in different licensing manuals. Spoiler alert, childcare has the very most. And licensed family childcare homes have the same amount as assisted care and living facilities, which is more than both dentistry and nursing homes. It's a lot. This doesn't make sense because licensing isn't always the best tool for the job. The topic around blocks that's come up several times, counting the blocks, having toys in a childcare program makes a ton of sense. That's not a good proxy for quality, right? What does the person who is there and responsible for the child do with the blocks to support that child's learning? That's really what we need to be getting at. So we do a lot of stuff in licensing that isn't a very good way of getting at quality, but we do it anyway because we've done it for a really long time. All of this kind of micromanagement amounts to a huge time tax on providers, right? It takes their attention away from children. And again, adult-child interactions are sort of the gold of childcare quality. That's where you get it. And so anytime we're asking providers to do something other than that, it should really be really, really important and make a lot of sense. It's also the case that the current approach makes being a licensor really challenging. And as Chair West mentioned, it doesn't allow licensors a lot of opportunity to offer technical assistance or support to providers. We don't have a lot of that in our system. And it's really what providers are craving and asking for. In short, again, we rely on licensing to accomplish a lot. And so I'll switch now from the kind of problem admiration state where we've been for a really long time and which I really don't enjoy, to talking about a different way forward that is a lot more like what happens in other professions. So I'll say at the outset, this is an outline, rough draft, been talking to people about it. Ms. Hanford mentioned, came up at a conference this summer, but it's something that there's a lot of excitement about. So part one would be to reduce the state's scope to assuring compliance with a streamlined licensing system focused on physical health and safety of children. Things like ratios, basic health and hygiene facilities, background checks, things are really important, but not things that duplicate quality metrics that are found elsewhere. So where could we look for those kinds of quality metrics? We could look to, as Representative Nadeau alluded to earlier, there are professional associations. There are associations for childcare professionals, just like there are for other professions that have outlined standards for themselves, that are in touch with best practice, that are kind of for us, by us, instead of having the state do all of that. And to get at what Ms. Sanford was talking about, we could have that system apply to all types of programs where kids are getting public subsidy to attend, and give all of those programs support. I think we talk a lot about school districts having lower standards. They also have really a lot lower supports, availability of and access to supports. And in the state, given where we are, we have a way of defining our highest quality programs, but I think we know based on real measures of quality that that level of quality isn't anywhere near where it could be to support our kids. And so we really need to lean in on supporting providers. And again, kind of eliminate this time tax that they're under for these regulations that don't do a lot to contribute to child development. This is a lot for one short presentation. I just wanted to say briefly, I had an opportunity to talk with the provider who was here last week, Maria Arms, about this idea. And it was really kind of amazing. She relaxed and said, huh, well, that makes sense. That was sort of the end of it. And I think that's kind of the reaction that I've been getting from talking to a lot of different, you know, people who work in this space, providers in this space. I just, the kind of level of anxiety and tension and yuckiness surrounding these conversations is what we haven't really been able to figure out and to break through. And I think a lot of that is because of this micromanagement. We don't trust childcare professionals like we trust other professionals, and we should figure out why that is. We should have like a therapy session or something to figure out why that is. you know, why do we have to tell them how to set the temperature? Do they not want to keep babies warm? I mean, I assume they do. They not want to go outside. You know, just I think getting into what's important to regulate, what kinds of proxies could we use for professionalism or, you know, national types of standards or other organizations, and how could we get out of this mess that we're in? So I was very inspired yesterday by the work that Representative Anderson talked about around the OIG bill, bipartisan, bicameral group of people, talking about a big idea, trying to work through the details. I would love to have something like that happen in this space. Think Small is definitely working with everybody who wants to talk about this, and we'll keep doing that. And we would invite you all into the conversation as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, you made it precisely on time.
That's so you'll invite me back, Mr. Chair. All right.
Chair Katizo-Toon, we'll have quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Moss, for being with us today.
Yeah.
As you kind of were walking through some of this, I couldn't help but think that you might have had a conversation with former Chair Pinto on this very topic. I might have missed what Representative Nadeau said. I was a little bit late to committee earlier, but we've been long talking about and discussing actually with DHS, and Representative Coulter and Representative Henningsen-Yeager were a part of some of those reactionary conversations that we had when the first draft of the regulations came out last spring about this very issue. Is there a way to license each individual provider instead of the building that they work in? And, you know, in a family child care center, that's one person, it's one building. Mm-hmm. The other side of the coin, one building, multiple providers. So what can we do to kind of move in that direction? And I think, you know, to your point about micromanagement, that is a direct quote that I've heard over and over again from Chair Pinto. So I think that there definitely is appetite to do something different. And I really appreciate you being able to share these thoughts with us today. Thank you.
Speaking of micromanagement, I could work on my time management. Committee's adjourned.
Thank you.